Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Shartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Monday, April 19th, Joe and Alan were joined by counterterrorism expert and best-selling author Malcolm Nance, political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson.
Well, it's the final phase of the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. It is wrapping up, and Minneapolis is bracing for unrest as Derek Chauvin trial ends that final phase. What we know of right now is that as of this morning, closing arguments are scheduled in the case. Officials, business owners, and residents across the city are afraid Minneapolis could see a repeat of the civil unrest that erupted after Floyd's death last May. The killing of an unarmed black man who was shot by a police officer during a traffic stop on April 11th has not only increased anxiety over the potential for violent protests and looting, but it has also created confusion over who is in charge of efforts to keep the city safe. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, and the city police chief and the county sheriff all share in the role, but they appear to hold different views on how best to respond. Last week, thousands of Minnesota National Guard troops began deploying throughout the city, taking up armed positions along commercial corridors and in residential neighborhoods alongside police officials and officers as part of what city and state officials describe as a deterrent to potential looting and violence in response to the Chauvin verdict. We could get a final verdict by mid to late week, so we shall see. Alan.
Well, you got to hope for the best and prepare for the worst. Of that, there is no question. And, if in fact what we're going to find is that the verdict is for Chauvin, the alleged perpetrator, lots of police verdicts are in these kinds of cases, then they'll be held to pay. There's no question about it. And that will open a whole new round of problems. So we're all sitting on pins and needles and waiting for this verdict and hoping that it will be a just one. It's that simple.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, I'm disappointed in a lot of the coverage right now that focuses disproportionately on what I would call bad apples or bad actors in the movement, in society, who take advantage of moments like this to do destructive things that are not part of the goals of the movement, right? And increasingly, I think what feeds into the tension is this idea that, you know, we can't separate, that we need to have a disproportionate response when there are bad actors mixed in with peaceful and sizable demonstrations. And I'm nervous about what's going to happen because I don't think that the sheriff locally and some of the other elected officials are really sort of sending the messaging that's required in order to prevent escalation of conflict in the community. And that being said, I place that squarely on these systemic problems that we have that I know that we'll get into more. And I don't mean to assume that the verdict will not be favorable. But it's more probable than not that the verdict will not feel satisfactory because George Floyd is gone. And the systems that resulted in his death remain largely intact. And until we see measurable, sustained reform of those systems, we will continue to see movements push and people push, and the power remain in the military and show of force context, and not with the people. So This is, we keep saying this, but this is a really historic moment to be alive. And I hope to be part of the solution as we sort of tease out the issues this morning.
Malcolm Nance.
Yeah, it's the framing that's happening right now in news media, and I work in news media. I'm saying the framing that they have in news media right now is the preparation for massive quantities of violence. And by doing that, what you're doing is you're setting the theme and creating this sort of bipolar world in which there can't be any justice if this verdict doesn't go as well as possible. And it pushes the themes that, you know, the black community needs this heavy hand of calling out the National Guard and the state police. The interesting component of this is all the major cities around the United States today that are preparing the National Guard and the police for this verdict. And that tells me quite a bit, certainly as an African-American man. One of the things that I noted when I was doing the research for my latest book about right-wing extremism is that last summer during the George Floyd protest, and I saw it myself and saw videos of this, the leading edge of all the violence and the destruction in the initial George Floyd protests, both in Portland and in Minneapolis, were white anarchist or white right-wing extremists who were coming out knowing that this would incite the crowd, smashing windows, enticing people to doing looting. Look, that's going to happen anyway. I'm from Philadelphia. I've seen a Super Bowl victory parade in my city. But to actually have agent provocateurs out there, they're going to be out there in force. And I hope that these communities, certainly in the black communities, that when they see these black bloc anarchist Antifa guys, or they see these people who are unidentified, they need to push them out. They need to get them out of the edge of the protest right away. And mainly most protests, 92%, can be peaceful like they were last summer.
And Libby Post.
Well, I don't have all that much to add between among Alan and Sarah and Malcolm. I do think that if there's violence, I hope there's not, but I'm sure there will be one way or the other. I do think you will see the right-wing provocateurs coming in, dressing in hoodies, dressing in clothing that they think the African-American community will stereotypically dress in, and be the first one to hurl the bricks in order to blame the Black Lives Matters movement for the violence. And I don't think there's any question of that whatsoever. Last night I watched 60 Minutes, The Oath Keepers. They had a segment on The Oath Keepers.
Yep.
And there were like three people from somewhere in the Midwest who were part of Oath Keepers, but didn't condone the storming of the Capitol. However, they did say that it was Black Lives Matter people who went and stormed the Capitol. So, you know, everyone's being brainwashed on all sides here to think that it's going to be the other person, the other organization, the opposition, to make our side look bad. We've seen this happen here in Albany. We saw this happen in Albany, and we will continue to see this happening everywhere else where the right wing does know what they're doing in terms of inflaming hatred and inciting violence.
Malcolm, you were talking about, I think both you and Sarah were mentioned about cities across the country. So what is it now that we do, not just in anticipation of this jury verdict, but going ahead and inevitably, I would assume, similar cases across the country that will unfortunately happen, because right now we seem to be in the cycle where they happen all too frequently.
Well, I just think it's unfortunate that major cities like New York City, Philadelphia, and others are leading not with quiet preparations for the possibility of violence, but they have it in their heads that Black Lives Matter, which is just a civil protest movement, is some sort of threat that requires thousands of National Guards people. Look, it's not Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is every black person in America. There is no organization. I mean, there is an organization, but it's the mindset of every African American in this country. And by making a lot of preparations, you know, for violence and extremism, they're putting out the message that we think you people are violent. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, again, I'm from Philadelphia. I've seen both the Super Bowl and the World Series won in my city, and they devastated the downtown of Philadelphia to the point where they have to preemptively start taking down poles. You know, in Center City, because, you know, they're $200,000 light poles, because the average Philadelphian will rip them apart if they have a victory. Well, you know, this, you know, America has a great history of protest, and it's one of the things that we cherish. But when African Americans do it, it's always considered some major mortal threat to the stability of the United States. And that's the exact issue that's at stake here. African Americans are treated differently when it comes to law and order. We want law and order. We want cops. We want our police forces funded. What we don't want is we don't want to be seen as a, you know, as an immediate threat by police who kill people by, you know, due to their mere existence. And I train cops all the time. They do have a warrior mindset. They do have a guns forward mindset. But it's weird because the people who have all the guns are not African Americans.
Alan?
Well, you know, my hat's off to Malcolm, of course, because he knows it, he's lived it, he sees it. I think that the idea of stereotyping the other guys is always dangerous. Nevertheless, I think some lend themselves to stereotypes, which always have a grain of truth more than others. I think the idea that black people in America are this united force, no, they're the ones who are picked on the most. Crime happens to black people more than it happens to white people, and we know that. So it's disgraceful to stereotype them as a crime-minded group. It's just part of what we live with here in the overall racist America.
Sarah?
Yeah, well, and it reminds me, I was rereading the letter to Southern women written back in the 60s by a woman who was a white ally to the civil rights movement. And it's a good reminder of how our society sort of talks women, and I would put business owners in this category too, into believing that you need a show of force or protection, or you need to have a heavy police presence in order to avoid black violence, right? And it's a myth. It's a story that we tell in order to continue to feed into these systems that are broken and to believe that they're required for our safety. And the way that we tell these stories feeds into that as well. That we have a long history and tradition of convincing ourselves that we need to protect, you know. And I would say that there is also that healthy slice of police that feel like they think that this is what they have to do to protect, and that it's not. And if we invested more in service, and this is too late, right? The stage has been set. It's too late now. I mean, it's not too late to draw down the National Guard. It's not too late to make a decision behind closed doors and to get all law enforcement on the same page instead of being confused and having different avenues for crowd control or crowd response, to resist the deployment of chemical weapons on our fellow Americans. You know, these are things that are not too late to do, right? And to focus on bad actors as opposed to protesters generally. But they're even at this point in Minneapolis, they're targeting the press. The press have been lined up by the police and marched through a line to have their photos taken. They're shooting rubber bullets. A journalist broke two bones in his hand had two bones. The police broke two bones in a journalist's hand as he was holding his camera up to his face. And rubber bullets are not supposed to be used above the neck. We can't fall prey to the myth that this is what is needed in our country. It's not.
Let's get to some letters. Mike says, right now we don't know what the verdict in the George Floyd murder trial will be, but I believe there is a better chance for holding bad cops accountable because of the body cams that police officers for the most part now wear and the videos taken by bystanders. Years ago, these videos didn't exist and bad cops rarely were held accountable. We also go to Robert. I'd like to ask what Malcolm sees as a possible coming civil war if this trial does not deliver real justice for Black Americans. The demonstrations will become a shooting gallery for racist police. Malcolm.
Well, the demonstrations have always been sort of a shooting gallery, and you see the really heavy-handed, and I'm afraid to say many of them are conservative, and they exercise their politics. You know, when they go around shooting journalists and with rubber bullets and batons. And can I point out something? The kind of ordinance that they use in Minneapolis and in Portland on any given night is a fraction of what they exercised on the day of the insurrection in Washington, D.C. Right. They use no sting balls, no flashbangs, no multi-bang grenades and things like that. So I don't think we're going to civil war, all right? We are not going to civil war. There are people out there called accelerationists, like the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys. They want civil war. These guys are living a Timothy McVeigh, you know, fantasy life. But the Black community just wants justice. That's not so hard to ask for. Everybody else gets it. We want equal justice under the law. And now, I mean, I can't see the case in turning against Officer Chauvin, if that doesn't lead to a conviction, just on the strength of the video alone, then something's really wrong with the system. It means Black people are not entitled to equal justice in the United States, and that police have immunity. And this will lock that up, and that's where you're going to get unrest. But we are not going to civil war.
Malcolm Nance on the Roundtable panel last Monday, April 19th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel the week in review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel of the Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. For Wednesday's show, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed President of the Albany branch of the NAACP, Deborah Brown Johnson, UAlbany Lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, Immigration Attorney and Partner with the Albany Law Firm of Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
Yesterday, it was announced right around 5 p.m. that Derek Chauvin was found guilty on all three counts, second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. This for the death of George Floyd, whose final breaths last May under the knee of Mr. Chauvin, a former Minneapolis police officer, were captured on video, setting off months of protests against the police abuse of Black people. After deliberating for about 10 hours over 2 days following an emotional trial that lasted 3 weeks, the jury found Mr. Chauvin, who is white, guilty of second-degree murder, as I mentioned, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter for the killing of Mr. Floyd, a Black man on the street corner last year on Memorial Day. So Let's start there and just go around and get everyone's reaction to the verdict, and then we'll go from there. Alan, start with you, and then we'll go to our panel.
Okay, I don't think it's a good idea to start with me. No disrespect meant, Joe, because we have such a distinguished panel who all are in a great position to be able to tell us what they think.
All right.
I do have a question for David Soares, however, which is whether he could distinguish, Joe, between all of those options that the jury had. I mean, can you be guilty of second-degree murder and third-degree murder, and it just shows you what I don't know.
David?
Yes, you can. You can. Each of those counts in that were charged to the jury, and we can delve into them a little bit more, required a certain mens rea. In other words, the top count required the intent, not the intent to cause the death, but the intent to commit the underlying felony, which was the assault or choking in this instance. So the prosecutors had to establish that he had intended to use his knee to assault without permission from Mr. Floyd. They had to demonstrate and prove intent on the second degree. Third degree did not require a showing of intent. It just simply required a showing of depraved indifference. In other words, the Chauvin had no regard for human life, and as he knelt down on Mr. Floyd's throat. And of course, the last count, which was a manslaughter, just required that the people show that the knee to the neck was obviously dangerous, although it wasn't a felony, that negligence caused an unnecessary risk, and that's called culpable negligence. So you can be guilty of all of them. The jury in this instance found that all of those elements were present, and the prosecution did a fantastic job of basically leaning in to the facts and the application of the law. We can get into the jury instructions a little bit later in the conversation, because I think the jury instructions and the hearing that took place late Thursday, was the most pivotal thing, I think, that led to the results that eventually we all shared in yesterday afternoon.
I do want to get into that. Let me go around the group here and get reaction from everyone, though. Deborah, let's begin with you. How did you take the – were you surprised, and how did you take the verdict?
Yes, I think like many Black people, I was surprised. I was hopeful all along. I am looking at the evidence. I believed he was guilty and was hopeful that it would the jury would come back with that decision. But as we know, how the experiences, the past experiences in this country, that has not always been the case. So when I heard it, there was a bit of shock. There was a bit of relief. And sorrow to think that another Black man had died. But I was pleased that the jury did listen, did see the evidence that was presented before them, and that a white police officer, for a time in my life that I can see, that a white police officer was charged and found accountable for the death of a Black man. And that's something that we have not seen. And so in that regard, justice was served. Accountability was rendered in this case.
Great points. And that idea of justice being served, and when especially, you know, it isn't, it's obviously not just that George Floyd is dead, but it is to at least see the accountability, which you mentioned, which is so important. Sienna, your thoughts?
For me, I always knew that the prosecution was putting forth a very strong case. I believe the turning point for me was when the police chief testified about his conduct. In our experience, when a police officer testifies counter to the defendant police officer, that is always going to be a more successful case. We've had cases before with videos, but for the police to, so to speak, break the blue wall of silence and testify about the conduct and that it was not a reasonable, something a reasonable officer would do, I think for me, that's when I knew that we were leaning towards a guilty verdict. The last case I remember in Texas in 2018, a police officer was convicted of, he was open fire on a black teen and he got shot. And what happened was his partner testified against him, saying that the partner did not feel like he was in danger. And that led to the conviction. So for me, this trial kind of mirrored the trial in Texas. And so I think the turning point was the police testifying against Derek Chauvin.
Jennifer Burns.
I am a little bit numb, I guess, because although this provides some accountability in this one incident, I'm left thinking, you know, what is it going to mean overall? Is this a one and done, you know, which we've seen sometimes in different cases involving the abuse and the harm of Black people? Or is it really going to lead to reform and reform of the system, not just leaning towards one bad apple? And in this case, I feel that some people are looking at this as, okay, we're going to look at it as individual officers, which is a positive thing. But it's not getting at many of the systemic racist issues that have created the problem and do need to be reformed. So I am pleased with the decision, but I'm also very, you know, cautiously optimistic at this point.
You have to start somewhere, right? And so... I mean, one of the big questions which I want to tackle this morning is this idea of, you know, how things would have been different if that young woman didn't have her phone in video mode when this happened. You know, where would we be and how would things be different, which gets to your point. David, just bring us real quick into where we are now as far as sentencing and when that'll take place. Chauvin was immediately remanded to jail, and sentencing will take place at a later date, and up to 40 years, right? So, but we don't. What goes into that decision?
Well, I have to tell you this: that I think the other shoe, and I agree with my colleagues on the panel here today, who the cautious optimism, because while, you know, I think those of us who are following this pretty closely, we had a sigh of relief. You know, the second shoe that drops here is the sentencing. And in Minnesota, what you have is a bifurcated proceeding, much like in the federal system, where you jury first must determine the guilt or innocence of a person who stands accused. And then after, if there is a finding of guilt, then there is a second proceeding where the people then have to present to the jury some aggravating factors in order to convince the judge to depart from the sentencing guidelines. In other words, here in New York, if a person commits murder, you know, the judge, within the judge's discretion, can sentence that individual 25 years to life or somewhere in that neighborhood, okay? But in Minnesota, there is a checklist because there is a sentencing guideline. So as we stand right here now, the exposure there for what he was convicted of is in fact 40 years, but it does not mean he's going to get 40 years. What it means is that that judge is going to take all of these factors, whether he's had a previous criminal history, all of those factors, and that judge will land on the number. That number, as it looks to me like right now, is going to be about 12 years, okay? So the people now, the same prosecutors now, will have to go before that judge because Chauvin, on Thursday, I believe, waived his right to have that hearing in front of the same jury. And so he's now going to allow the judge to listen to the prosecution and the defense and allow that judge to be able to do the sentencing after the people present the aggravating factors. The aggravating factors that the people will be presenting is the fact that Floyd was handcuffed, after he was handcuffed, he was in a very vulnerable position, and he was treated with particular cruelty. The other thing that they'll have to prove and establish is that Chauvin abused his authority. And more importantly here, I think, at least I think that will make sense to a judge, is that Chauvin committed these crimes in front of a number of children. Mm. And I think that those aggravating factors will influence the judge to depart upwardly from the 12 years that Chauvin is sitting on right now.
David, we were talking about the directions to the jury. Talk a little bit about that and why that was so significant.
Well, you know, so I think what folks missed a little bit last week was the battle that was taking place after all the proof had gone in. And that's usually during the charging decisions. And I thought, and I had a great feeling about the people's case after the judge had ultimately decided what he was going to do in terms of jury instructions, because the use of force instructions were particularly important. Now, in this setting, in Minnesota, with the facts of this case, the people wanted an objective, reasonable standard, meaning if force wasn't necessary, then it wasn't reasonable. That's an objective, reasonable standard. And the language would be, any use of force beyond what was necessary was not reasonable. The jury, the instruction to the jury is, you must decide whether the officer's action were objectively reasonable based on the totality of facts and circumstances confronting the officer without, and this is very important, without regard to the officer's own state of mind, intention, or motivation. That's what the prosecutors argued aggressively for. So what they wanted was for the jurors to not have to place themselves in the mind of Chauvin, but use an objective, reasonable standard. The defense was arguing that for the language that reads as follows: the reasonableness of a particular use of force must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer at the moment he is on the scene, rather than the 2020 vision of hindsight. So the defense was arguing for an instruction that would have allowed for the jury to place themselves in the mind of Mr. Chauvin. And the people won out in the jury instructions. And so I thought that was extremely important. And I think it led to the relative quick time that the jurors had gotten the case and then ultimately made their decision. So I thought that the pivotal thing that occurred last week was the instructions.
Yeah, Sienna, did that surprise you that it only took 10 hours?
Oh, yes. I was very surprised. As a former public defender, that would be, that is usually not a good thing for the defendant. And especially in light of the fact that there was medical testimony for them to go through, jury instructions, as David just mentioned, for them to go through, and that they didn't have any questions for the judge. So I was very shocked at how fast they deliberated that.
Yeah. I know that did seem to be, for many of the analysts that I was watching yesterday, seemed to be the fact that nobody had any questions. There were no questions on that jury. Deborah, when you look at this and you see what had to go through, I guess I'm interested in how you perceive the trial, of how it went, and because on one hand you can say, well, you know, this went well, but by the same token, you know, how could it not when you saw the evidence against Derek Chauvin?
Right. I think for us, for me, the important thing was the important thing was the trial. I thought, being a novice and not an attorney, I thought it went well. I was able to follow the information, the presentation of the information by the attorney, and understanding just thinking from a perspective of the juror, that it was information that was clear, the witnesses were clear, that you could put the pieces together, you could connect the dots. Mm. always, but, you know, being an advocate and in civil rights, we're always concerned because history tells us it doesn't always work out the way you think it should. It doesn't always work out even when there are when there is evidence clear and convincing that you believe. It doesn't always come out that way. So there's still that apprehension that's there. But looking at this case, we thought it was clear. Thought the evidence was there, and had concerns. I think, as David and others have raised, when you think about who witnessed this, that it was a 17-year-old that took the video, that she had an 11-year-old with her that was witnessing this happening in their community to someone that looks like them, you know, therein lies the concern about what's going to happen and what will be the outcome and the result. So even when it looks good, when it looks clear, when it looks obvious to everyone, the outcome doesn't always play out that way. And that is always the concern. And that's why we still have hope, but reality sets in along that thinking and that continuum.
Jennifer.
What I struggle with is the amount. I mean, it was, to me, very open and closed. I mean, it was a shut right. case. It was very obvious, right? But, you know, Biden touched on this last night with these exceptional circumstances, having the video, having all the people, all of these things having to come together. Whereas we know in the past, without all of these pieces, people walk. And so I'm concerned about, you know, how things are going to proceed with what it will take in other cases. Will there have to be multiple videos? Will there have to be these things in broad daylight for us to see more convictions when we see excessive force used by police officers? And, you know, I'm also interested in the individual, you know, jurors, like, what were they thinking? So I'm kind of obsessed right now with wanting interviews right. with them and, you know, what their thoughts were during this process and not getting into Chauvin's brain, because I think, you know, that teeters on, is he racist or is he not? And the prosecutors really tried to stay away from making this about race, because we know people tend to not want to convict anybody or charge anyone with being racist. So that's where I'm still, you know, obsessed with this case. And then, of course, the sentencing, and how will the sentencing and this conviction impact the other three officers when their trial comes up, or will it not at all?
Jennifer Burns on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, April 21st. Please note, as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed and evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Thursday, April 22nd, Earth Day, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok spoke with environmental writers and thinkers Judith Enck, Jeff Goodell, and Elizabeth Colbert.
So let's start with the news of the day, which is President Biden is committing the U.S. to having greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. He made the announcement today during a virtual summit on climate change with 40 world leaders. The target proclaims America's return to a position of leadership and urges other countries to make steep cuts. So I know both of you, both Elizabeth and Jeff, have written about this Biden and his plans for the climate. So, Elizabeth, let me begin with you of what you make of this commitment to the U.S. having greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, to having them.
Yes, having and having.
Yes.
Well, it was kind of an interesting whiplash day reading the headlines in the paper today. One headline was greenhouse gas emissions are set to increase again as, you know, economies emerge from COVID. And another that the Biden administration is setting these very ambitious climate goals. 2030 is really not very far from now, as everybody knows. So I guess on the one hand, you know, I would say, great, it's fantastic that the administration is being incredibly ambitious. That's absolutely the global leadership that we need. But I would feel a lot more, you know, sort of sanguine if I knew, if I saw a detailed plan for how they were going to get there.
You write in the April 12th edition of The New Yorker, the green spending Biden is proposing is contained in a $2 trillion package so sprawling that would affect just about every aspect of American life. Is it too sprawling? I mean, does that make it difficult to know exactly where the money is going to go and how we keep track of it?
Well, I think what we really don't know at this point is, you know, we don't have the legislation. We don't know. We just have this sort of proposal that lists broad categories of spending. And, you know, everyone who listens to WAMC knows that the process of actually enacting legislation, writing the legislation and getting it through Congress, especially getting it through this very, very closely divided Senate, we really don't have a very clear idea at all of what's going to finally emerge in the final package, if there even is a final package. So all we have is this pretty broad outline at this point.
Jeff Goodell, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Betsy is absolutely right about all this. This is all, you know, very impressive goals. You know, Biden has certainly assembled a very impressive team at the White House. He's clearly very serious about this. You know, everyone from bringing back Gina McCarthy and John Kerry, and you know, he has a much broader view of climate action than even, you know, certainly than the Obama administration had. Not to mention, of course, the failures of the Republican administrations on this. And so he really sees this as, you know, this sort of large-scale transformation that is really going to be required for the climate crisis. But, you know, we still have, you know, a political party and a political apparatus in America that is not budging on this. And, you know, how this ambition gets translated into actual action and it gets translated into actual legislation, as Betsy said, is really the big question at this moment.
Judah, thank.
Well, there's no detailed roadmap on how you get to this goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions by 50 or 52% by 2030. So that's where it matters. And I think we'll get there. I know that history is littered with examples of aspirational goals that never get impacted or implemented, particularly on climate change. And one thing I've learned from my service in state government and federal government is the worst thing you want is a goal that's long into the distance and then no milestones, no checkpoints to see if you're actually achieving the aspirational goals and incremental steps. And it's amazing how governments make that mistake over and over again. I am optimistic here, though, because I think Biden and Kamala Harris understand the urgency of this issue. They know that we wasted the last 4 years, valuable years during the Trump administration. And they've put together a serious team. Certainly Jeff mentioned Gina McCarthy and John Kerry, but also when you look at assistant administrator level at EPA, you know, there's a team of people who know how to get stuff done. What we still need to do is mobilize public support. We shouldn't just outsource this to the president. He can't do it alone. And there is the little problem of Congress. I think the Biden people are being unrealistic in saying that they can do a lot of this administratively and they don't need Congress. But I think, you know, the first indicator is the infrastructure bill. There's a lot of good provisions in there to drive down greenhouse gas emissions. Chuck Schumer is so energized about electric vehicles because he also sees the job creating potential. So will we see a comprehensive infrastructure bill, and will we have legally mandated target reductions? That will tell us how real this is.
Alan, as a political scientist, to Judith's point about Congress, so how does this all go down, do you think?
Not only Congress, but journalism also. You know, we were talking on the Media Project this morning about this. And you know how how they put a box on saying 22 days till this is going to happen and that's going to happen?
Yeah.
I was thinking, wouldn't it be great to be able to say, figure out statistically, how long before the Earth turns into Mars? Until it's, you know,
tick, we tick, have these tick, boom.
Until we have these deserts. And then you put a little thing in the paper, a box, or on the news saying, we're gonna be Mars in whatever. And then you count down the days and you make people aware every day that we're getting closer and closer to destruction for ourselves, our kids, and their kids, and their kids. So I think a lot is going to depend on journalism. Now, there was a question in there somewhere, right, Joe? About
Congress, about there is what Biden wants to do and what he announced today, How do you get it through?
Well, it's tough. You got an absolute split there. On the George Floyd thing, it looks like police reform is something that is going to get done. We're seeing that there's some movement with the Republicans. On climate change, I really want to hear from the experts as to what, you know, these people are all dependent on Donald Trump, and they see it, and they won't have integrity. What they're doing is they're saying, I'm not going to do anything that's going to spoil my political chances. And there, I'd love to hear from the experts.
You know, Judith, you brought up an interesting point that I'd like Jeff to comment on, because when you were talking about history and what we've learned over the years, you have a quote in your article in this month's Rolling Stone magazine, Jeff, which there's an incredible section in the magazine on climate crisis, which you have an article, but also an amazing interview with John Kerry, which we'll talk about in a second. But there's a quote in there that says, "We're now in a world where the past is no longer a good guide to the future," said one expert. "We have to get much better at preparing for the unexpected." And my immediate reaction to that is, oh, God, what could be more unexpected than what we're already dealing with? And I guess it isn't really all that unexpected, but still, it seems like we're being thrown a lot at once.
Yeah, well, you know, I think one of the ways that we talk about the climate crisis that really is misguided is this constant looking for solutions and fixing. You know, there's a kind of unspoken aspect of this that, you know, the climate change is like a broken leg, that if we just, you know, go to the doctor and sit down and get a cast for 6 weeks, we'll fix this, and then we'll go back to our normal lives and we'll be okay. We can go play football again. That's not what's going on here. I mean, this is, even in the best case scenarios, we are transforming into a kind of different world. It's a different world that will not be powered by fossil fuels. It will be powered by different kinds of renewable energy. Sooner or later, that transition is absolutely going to happen. And, you know, we're going to be living in a world with different rainfall patterns, different temperatures. We are not going back to where we were. And how to prepare for that and how to think about that and how to, you know, pick the best path forward for that transition is really what we're talking about here.
One of the things that you, again, bring up is, I mean, the name of the article is Our Last Best Chance, and you make the point that the clock is ticking and there is no more room for error. Judith said, look, we basically gave up 4 years. So how do we keep the eyes on the prize then over the next 4, perhaps 8 years to work on this together?
Well, that's like that's the big question. How we mobilize, as Judith talked about, kind of political support, and not just throw this into the hands of the president and say, you know, you take care of this, Joe, and I'm going to go back to, you know, drinking my beer in the backyard. You know, I think that it's important in this notion that this is, you know, we call this piece our last best chance. It's not like, you know, if we don't do it now, the world ends. What we're talking about is trying to keep reduce the risk as much as possible. But this is not a like situation where if we don't do this, we fail. Every ton of CO2 that we prohibit from going into the atmosphere is a good thing. You know, we are making choices now about the path that we're taking forward. And I think that this, you know, there's been a lot of criticism of this sort of doomsday framing of this, you know, and I think that that's really important to stress also, that, you know, this is not a, it's not like we get a pass fail grade with this. It's like a decision with every ton of CO2 we put into the atmosphere of what kind of world we're building for the future.
However, you end the article.
it's trying to be upbeat, Joe.
No, I know. It is, but it's a quote. It's John Podesta. Yes. And the quote is, this is it, Warren's Podesta, but this really is it. If we don't amp up and accelerate the energy transformation in this decade, we're goners, really goners.
Well, I don't think he's, I don't think he means like, you know, it means that we're going to where Alan was talking about with Mars. It doesn't mean that if we don't do it now, we're Mars. I think what he's talking about is, you know, we can abandon the idea that we're going to keep this warming below 1.5 degrees or even perhaps 2 degrees if we don't take action now. Because this really is a race against time. I mean, this is, you know, we all know that this, you know, transition away from fossil fuels is going to happen. There's an inevitability about that, but it needs to happen sooner rather than later. But I also think that John Podesta was talking about, you know, this sort of political framework that we're thinking about now, that we can do this, that we can hit these goals. If we don't do it now, then these goals are we can just abandon them, and we have to think differently about this, the whole political process that we're engaged in now.
Elizabeth, let me ask you, we've been talking about the Biden pledge and what he's talking about at this global summit this morning, and Judith touched on this, of course, about the last 4 years of the Trump administration. When you go on a world stage and you're President Biden, how do you restore trust in American leadership?
Well, I think that is extremely difficult, and there was a great quote from a Chinese minister, I think it was in the Times, where he said, you know, they're not leaders, they're like, you know, kids who've been playing hooky for 4 years and now they come back. So I think that they're, you know, that was obviously also said in a strategic way. So, you know, there's a lot of diplomacy or non-diplomacy going on there. But, you know, I think that it's impossible for America's even our best allies, our closest allies, not to be skeptical of American pledges. It's, you know, we've been in this pattern since 1992 when George H.W. Bush went to Rio and, you know, signed the original climate framework, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and said, you know, we're going to fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect. And we've been on this roller coaster since then, where every 4, sometimes even 2, sometimes we don't even wait 4 years, sometimes it's 2 years, we sort of flip around. And the Trump administration, you know, completely, the Obama administration was slow on climate change, I think, that they would even acknowledge that now. And then finally, toward the end of the administration, you know, really tried to make up for lost time, really was instrumental in getting a handshake with the Chinese and getting the Paris Accord But the Paris Accord is structured the way it is because everyone knew the U.S. Senate will never pass a climate treaty. So we already sort of start out as in the doghouse here. And then the Trump administration just, you know, spent 4 years systematically, and I mean quite ruthlessly, undoing everything the Obama administration had done on the environment, not just on climate change, but very much all focused on anything that had to do with climate change. And so the first thing that the Biden administration has to do, you know, before we even get to the new stuff, is undo all the stuff that the Trump administration did. So there's tons of lawsuits. The Biden administration will, you know, no longer defend the old regs that the regulations that the Trump people were trying to put in to replace the Obama administration's regulations. But that's a time-consuming and laborious process that will waste a lot of time that, as you suggested, we don't really have. So, you know, I think one of the things that motivates the Biden people here also is the sense that maybe they don't even have 4 years. Maybe they only have 2 years. You know, so right. It's a very, very difficult situation.
Judith, your thoughts on that and the back and forth.
Yeah, you know, I think Betsy is absolutely right. The United States doesn't have clean hands. And that's got to change rapidly. I mean, the top greenhouse gas emitter in the world is China at 28% and the United States at 14%. So we've got to get that relationship right, even if it means compartmentalizing issues so we can engage China and then, you know, engage our own businesses and our own state governments and local governments. And while the Trump administration, quite honestly, could not have been worse on climate change and virtually every single environmental issue, my God, I still have post-traumatic stress thinking about the environmental policies of that tenure there. I also want to point out that Democrats need to be much stronger. You know, I'm sorry to say our own local Congress member, Paul Tonko, has introduced a bill called the Clean Future Act, which includes federal tax credits to encourage the incineration of solid waste. It's as if he didn't remember what happened at the Albany Answers plant, a major environmental justice issue. When you burn garbage, if you look at the amount of energy produced in terms of what's being burned, there's more carbon emissions than when you burn coal. So what are the Democrats doing? Pushing legislation, subsidizing garbage burning. And in New York State, Governor Cuomo talks a good game on renewables and energy efficiency, but when you take out the really old large-scale hydro projects run by the New York Power Authority, which have been around for over 50 years, New York is only at 5% renewable energy. We're behind Texas. We're behind California, state of Washington, Oregon. So, you know, the climate issue needs to be tackled at every level of government. We need to pull all the levers we can, and don't assume that the Democrats are going to go to the mat on this stuff unless the public mobilizes and holds them accountable.
Judith Eng on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, April 22nd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. You may contact us by emailing roundtable@wamc.org. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.